Got a great show here today. I'm going to have Mark Alexander. He's age 30 and under, and he is our in-studio correspondent. Welcome again to Youth for Justice.
Good to be here.
Yeah, we're always happy to have Mark. Mark plays a very critical role for our production. He listens and takes notes for all the interviews we do, and he asks some really cool, poignant questions. So we're always happy to have Mark on board. Quick lowdown of the show we have in the studio. Bianca Kilantan. Bianca Kilantan. And she is a journalist, and we're going to be interviewing her like we did for some interviews we did with Howard Hardy from the Chico News and Review and Asia from the ER. And we also have, after Bianca, we have a really beautiful piece. It's my niece who has her family history of moving here from Cuba, immigrating from Cuba, and her dad came over on a raft from Cuba. And that is just a gorgeous, gorgeous story. And then we end the show with Butte Environmental Council telling us all things we need to know about endangered species fairs and making giant puppets. We had such a fun time putting that together. And then we are going to have Kay Alba back on. We had such a great studio and post-studio response to her performance. She's going to do the ending song, and she's going to roll right into Beatle Nation. So that's basically what we got going on here. And before we interview here with Bianca, we're going to give you a little Will Durst here on People Powered Radio.
Words about how exciting the news is these days. Too exciting. Like the pre-credits sequence of a science fiction film that takes place in the ruins of a dystopian civilization. It's not just we news junkies, the whole nation is transfixed. An unprecedented number of eyeballs are trolling the interwebs. Ratings for Fox News and MSNBC are shooting past the outer orbit of the moons of Mercury. Even such olden-timey formats as newspapers are flying off shelves. Wouldn't be surprised to hear that kindling and blanket sales are way up for those who remain partial to smoke signals. Every single day, there's danger, intrigue, romance, treachery, internecine warfare, skulking, lurking, barking. No sex yet, but you know it's coming. It's like a soap opera with ugly people. The House Intelligence Committee, which is a bit of an oxymoron, has a chairman playing cloak and dagger on the White House grounds, receiving classified documents from staffers that he later relays to the president himself. Peter slipping Paul a note to give back to Peter's boss. Terrorism expert Clint Watts told the Senate Intelligence Committee, not as big an oxymoron, to follow the trail of dead Russians. This is House of Cards, with Kevin Spacey playing all the parts, meets James Bond. But not the cool young Daniel Craig James Bond, more like one of Roger Moore's last appearances. White House spokesman Sean Spicer creeps closer and closer to his inevitable televised breakdown. Won't be long before he shows up at a press briefing, wearing his tie as a bandana with a knife gripped between his teeth. And now the former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, announces he wants immunity to testify. Immunity for what? And testify about what? Nobody knows. And we're only 2 months in. Stay tuned. This is going to make Legion look like Leave It to Beaver. For KZFR Radio, I'm Will Durst.
He sure is, man. I got to meet Will Durst. He comes through town a fair amount. So thanks, Will Durst, for supporting People Powered Radio. It is now my distinct pleasure to introduce to our studio audience and to our listening audience, Bianca Kilantan. And Bianca Kilantan is a journalist, and she does work with AC Press, the Orion News, Chico Soul News, Chico ER. You've got a lot going on, Bianca, man.
A little bit.
Welcome to KZFR, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So maybe before I do the quick introductions, I did want to say this is kind of a continuation of I mentioned that before, but the actual theme was journalism, the craft, the First Amendment, and local reporting, the values of roles of print, online, and citizen journalism. And with no further ado, maybe you can add a little bit more. What else do folks need to know about Bianca and maybe some of the things you like to do?
Well, I was fortunate enough to move up here to Chico in August. And so I've only been here for about 10 months. And luckily, I was immediately like I dove into Chico Soul, which is our border and immigration kind of reporting, as well as investigative local reporting. And I also became part of the Orion staff, which I'm now the news editor for. I also am the starving student columnist for the Chico ER. And I do a lot of freelancing on my own as well. So that's the kind of journalism I've been doing. I focus a lot on the diversity issues around, as well as immigration and border issues.
I thought it was such a neat little backstory that we talked about in the green room, Bianca, of how Dave Waddell had recruited you. Maybe a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we've had this pipeline at Southwestern College, which is 11 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border with Tijuana. And so Dave has been coming down and recruiting us to kind of diversify the Orion staff for the past, I don't know, very long time, it seems. Yeah. And so I actually got recruited, and that's how I came here. I didn't even know Chico existed.
Well, we're glad that Dave reached out to you and that you're here in Chico.
I am too.
So tell us a little bit about why you became a journalist, Bianca.
So honestly, I was not supposed to be a journalist. I actually was a pre-med bio major and had decided to take a class for journalism, and my advisor sucked me in. So my first assignment, he's like, "You look like a great photographer. You should be a photographer." So I went on a photography assignment, and the writer never showed. And the assignment was on these undocumented workers that usually sit outside of construction sites or, you know, Home Depots. And they sit there and ask for money and wait for people to pick them up for work. So I was crouched down and I was taking a photo of this man, and he's like, "Hey," in Spanish, he's like, "Mija, come over here, you know, do you mind taking a picture of me and my son?" And I was like, "Oh, sure, you know, why not?" So I went over to take a photo of him, and he's like, I was like, "Would you like to smile?" He said, "No, I don't have any teeth." And so a 67-year-old man decided to just tell me everything about his life, how he came from Jalisco, how he wanted to like reunite with his family in Utah, and how, you know, he had come across illegally and he can't get enough money to get to Utah because no one will give a 67-year-old migrant man work. And so it was an interesting story, because as soon as like the other compadres started hearing us speak in Spanish, they felt comfortable enough to chime in with stories of this man got his hand cut, or his son-in-law's hand cut off and sent to him in a box from a cartel dealer because he had stolen from our cartel. And so he had to pack up his family and come across the border. And they lived in the canyons by the sides of the Home Depot. The other one was like, "I make $40 a week. I can't support my twins and my wife in Mexico. So that's why I'm here."
So you enjoy talking to people and people like talking with you. Would that be a fair assessment?
I guess so.
Yeah,
I guess so.
I can see that. You have such a way about you, you know, that I feel comfortable talking with you right now on the air. Yeah. So what's some of your favorite things about the job?
My favorite things about the job is getting to tell stories that are often not told in in bigger media sources. So I work for smaller media sources around, you know, local Chico, and I get to tell stories about, you know, homeless students. I get to tell stories about undocumented students. And it's those stories that are often ignored that I get to tell.
Mm-hmm. What about least favorite things? Are there some least favorite things? Maybe you
least
love it all?
Least favorite things? Well, as a college journalist, it's frightening to not have like a secure job, I guess, in the future. And that's the biggest fear a lot of students have that are journalism majors. They're like, "Where are we going to work?" And with a, you know, medium, like, it's changing very rapidly. Yeah. I have to learn coding. I have to learn how to do video. I have to learn how to do everything in order to be considered for a job now.
Mm-hmm. So what we have this really kind of cool question, then we did the other ones. A lot of time was spent on this one, but we're talking about First Amendment and how integral the First Amendment is to the work you do in print media, you know, access of the press, freedom of the press.
It's absolutely integral. Like, the whole institution of journalism is based on the First Amendment. Without the First Amendment, there would be no journalists. And so, you know, with the First Amendment, we have the right to speak our own minds. We have the right to also tell people what is going on, what they may not be know what is going on, essentially. So our job essentially was created out of being the watchdogs for government. And I feel like that's what we do every day. That's what we do. We look out for other people, and we look out for, you know, everyone, essentially, by telling you what is happening.
Mm-hmm. Getting to the truth. That's what Dave and I talked a lot about. Yes. That's the essence of journalism, is seeking the truth, reporting the truth to the very best of your ability, because nothing's infallible. Nothing is infallible. Actually, I'll make a quote because you said you're having to do some code. I told Dave I used to code. I said the only such thing as a error-proof code is one that hasn't been properly tested. So, you know, you're always trying to do the very best you can. This next one it was just the humanity of the journalist and the perils of secondary trauma. You know, when you research folks that are dealing with quote-unquote compassion fatigue or, you know, post-traumatic stress, journalism's right up there near the top. I mean, what would you share on your experiences with that, Bianca?
I've had a lot of different experiences. There's always been that struggle. I actually, at my previous newspaper, I covered a story where the college administrators had been they didn't want to admit that there was a sexual assault problem on the college campus. We had run a story with three Jane Doe sources, and just because they were Jane Doe's and not named, because traditionally, as journalists, we're told to leave out the names of sexual assault victims, but because we did that, the administrators, the president, the university police chief, they didn't believe it was true. They didn't want to believe it was true. They didn't record it in any of their recordings for statistics of rape or assault or harassment or anything. And so, in response, I compiled stories from 13 men and women who had experiences with sexual assault and harassment. And so I had to sit down with 13 women and men who were brave enough to tell me their stories. Some of them had never told their sexual assault or rape stories to anyone else before. And so I'm sitting in the room, and this woman's telling me that she was raped by her previous partner, and they had a BDSM relationship. And it was difficult for me to understand, it was difficult for me to understand how she was able to share this with me. A complete stranger that she didn't know, and she had never shared it with her family. And she's also a Latina, so, you know, her partner was a woman too. So she could never tell her parents because it's looked down upon to be bisexual or to be, you know, homosexual in the Latino culture, unfortunately. And so, you know, you're sitting there and you're interviewing her, and she's fighting tears to tell you her story, and you're trying to keep it together because that's your job, to keep it together. Mm-hmm. And it was difficult. I would go home and I would tell my mom, like, I don't know if I can do another one the next day. It's difficult. But the fact that, you know, I would get messages after or calls from the women and men, and they would tell me, I thank you for allowing me to speak about this. I've never felt able to speak about this. And they felt a sense of empowerment afterwards, which was the most rewarding part of this.
That's the most, Dave and I talked a lot in that long form piece. That's the most rewarding thing I've had, following back with people, and, you know, how much hope and power it gave them to have their voice out there. So thank you so much for that. I guess one more other thing I'd kind of color this. There was someone in the community that reached out to me and said, hey, would you like to help us do homeless interviews? It's a nonprofit. And I was like, well, I can't do it. This person actually did the interviews, and she came back to me and she says, I don't know how you do this, you know, quote unquote, as much as you've done, because I was near tears the whole time, and it bugged me, you know, when I went home. So thank you for sharing some humility around that. I appreciate that. Any wrap up, closing comments, maybe something we could circle back on or something we haven't talked about, Bianca?
You know, I really love the institution of journalism. I don't know how I didn't find it sooner. It provides that human angle to most stories that are often heavily politicized, especially in the immigration kinds of things, like the story that's coming up soon. And so I just appreciate journalism and telling the truth to the fullest.
That's wonderful. Mark, you got any follow-on questions for Bianca, Mark Alexander? And
questions. I was kind of curious about your thoughts about, I think lately there's been a lot of people who've kind of, given the last election, a lot of people have been talking about using terms like fake news, and I was wondering about if you had any comments about some people losing their confidence in the reliability of journalism.
You know, the only way we're going to be able to combat that is by telling the truth and continuously providing good long-form journalism. I know currently the problem with journalism is that some people think it's too long, and that's where we fall short. Some mediums take maybe a minute to cover a story. Some people take 100 words to cover a story. And with that, we're not covering the entire story. And so most of the bigger news outlets, unfortunately, are failing their audiences by cutting out parts of the story in order to keep up with what they say are the short attention spans of readers. Readers want to know what is happening, and citizens want to know what is happening. So it's our job to tell them everything and lay it all out there, not cut it down to make it bite-sized for people. Because Whoever wants to read it will read it. If it's a good story, they will read it.
Yeah, exactly. To me, if you want bite-sized, watch evening news. And I don't watch evening news. Sorry.
It's funny because right after I asked the question, I was like, well, come to think of it, maybe it's just that people don't want to actually do the research to realize that this source isn't actually giving them all the whole story or all the information.
Yeah, exactly.
That could be the problem. I mean, our newest thing is that we have to give you bite-sized news in tweets. That is 140 characters. I don't know how people expect a whole story in 140 characters. But if journalists take the entire effort to do the whole 20-page story or a 2,000-word story, that gives you all the information with links to get to other parts if you want to research it yourself. And so that's the journalism that needs to be done. We have to give you the whole entire piece in order for you to actually have the information to do.
I can see why you hooked up with Chico Soul. That's their whole backbone, is investigative journalism, long-form piece. And I know they're really happy to have you on board, Bianca. So for listeners just joining, we just interviewed Bianca Quilantoine. And she's a journalist, local journalist here in Chico, California. But I just wanted to end the show, maybe a little comment around, just as we did with Howard, I have an interview with Howard in the can, and I'm going to be bringing Asia back. And I'd like to offer you the same opportunity to have a longer piece, 15 minutes, around just some stories. You can talk about, you know, the experience of reporting those stories and how the craft of journalism applies to physical articles you've written.
I'd love to come back and talk about them. Absolutely.
We'd love to have you. All right, then. Well, thanks again for coming on in, Bianca. We're going to transition now to my niece. You know, I was in Florida, and I got to spend some time with my niece, and she explained how her dad came over here on a raft, and I'm like, man, and she's in her mid-20s, and this is just a really good piece, and it fits into what some of the Chico Soul articles are looking at for, you know, how folks came to America and how we should be welcoming and accommodating. And no further ado, here on People Powered Radio. So just a quick introduction. Talia Federico is a graduate of Central Florida with a med lab science major, who currently works at John Hopkins. And where's John Hopkins located? Maybe a little bit about your job.
It's in Baltimore in Maryland. And my job pretty much consists of such a wide range of things. You can do laboratory tests on blood samples, any kind of fluids that can be collected from the human body. We can run chemistry tests on, like spinal fluids or urine or any kind of fluid that might build up in the body. We also do microbiology, hematology, in addition to chemistry, immunology, and blood bank, which is where I'm currently doing blood bank right now. I had to switch from the core lab to doing just blood bank to have a little bit more of an impact on the patients. So nice. I just did that switch.
Must be nice to be, you know, working in your major, working what you went to school for.
Oh, yeah. I definitely wasn't willing. I mean, anyone would be willing to after a while, but I spent a couple months looking for a job in that major, and I didn't want to give up since that's what I went to school for. I'm glad I was able to find it. It took a while, like 4 months.
So that's a good thing for our listeners, our young listeners out there. You know, you've got a dream, you got a vision, you got a background. Go for it, man. Don't settle for second best. Settle for first best. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit, Talia, about your immediate family and their heritage?
Okay. Well, my entire family is Cuban, and everybody was born there. My parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, as far back as we can keep track of, except for my little sister, who was born here in the United States. I was born in Cuba, too, and I came over to the United States when I was about 5 years old.
So what's your memories of Cuba, Talia, from 0 to 5 years old?
Oh, when I was little, I have memories of my mom sitting with me on the porch, rocking me on this old wooden rocker and singing to me when I was a little girl. I have memories of going to the beach there and eating an ice cream cone. Not an ice cream, just the cone part, like the waffle cone. I remember thinking, is this paper or is this something we can eat? I have this memory of us at the beach there. And of my family, like my grandparents, my aunts and uncles when I was little.
They're all fond memories, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
You have all fond memories. And I've talked to a few people that have been from Cuba, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful place to be from, as far as I can tell.
I think the people there are great. I'm probably a little biased, but...
That's okay.
I think they're really great, yeah.
With no further ado, I mean, you had talked about how your dad had come over on a raft at least once or twice. So try to give our listeners an understanding of, you know, what your family had to do to become part of this wonderful society called the United States of America.
Sure. So my dad came over on this little raft that they put together with like surfboards and random pieces of rubber. They were working on it, from what I understand, for a couple of months. I say they, it was him and a couple of other guys that he was friends with at the time. So they put together this raft, and then they just kind of set off to the ocean and tried to make it to the United States. There's no motor. There's not really any kind of, as far as I can tell, plan, because you can't take too long and then risk people finding out. And he said he didn't even tell my mom that he was leaving. So one day he just left, and I think he left her a letter. And eventually after he was able to come here, he did eventually communicate with her and let her know what was going on. But for the first couple of years of my life, because he was there when I was born, but I don't remember him once I started to have memories as a little kid. So the first couple of years of my life until I was 5 and I finally came here, I didn't even have him in my life because he had traveled over here on that raft. I think it was 4 or 5 guys went with him. And I actually saw a picture of the raft, and it looks like this tiny, dingy little thing that you would never want to cross the ocean in. But, like, luckily they made it. And he was able to come over to the United States, and he was able to, like, claim, I think, refugee status here. And through a legal process, what I don't know the details of, he was able to claim me and my mom, and we were able to come over on a plane. And I think it was about 3 years later, maybe 3 or 4 years later, that he was able to get us to come over here. I would say the first time I saw him, I knew he was my dad, but I had never actually seen him before. So it was like a really interesting experience.
Wow. I wish I could have been a fly on the wall for that. That must have been a beautiful experience. So at that point, you hadn't seen him like 2-3 years or how long?
I had no memory of having seen him before that. He would call on the phone, and my mom would say, "That's your dad, talk to him." But as a little girl, like, I had never, ever seen him before until I got off that plane.
So why don't we try to recreate that possibly, if that's even possible? So you go down the walkway, and you walk out into the terminal, and there's your dad.
Yeah, and my mom pointed him out, and he was wearing, like, this striped shirt, and he had long hair. Because he decided he was, some people, they say, "I'm not going to do a certain thing until I achieve this goal." So his thing was like, "I'm not cutting my hair until I see my family." I don't know why that was important to him, but that's just something that he held on to. So the first time I saw him, he looked kind of like a hippie. He had like long hair and like these John Lennon circular sunglasses and jeans. And he was there with my mom's stepmother, who had also been able to come over to the United States, and they were all waiting for us, and they had like a gift for me, and they ran up to us, and everybody started crying. And as a little girl, I remember, like, "I'm happy, this is my dad," but I wasn't crying because it wasn't that same kind of emotion that, you know, the adults, like my mom and her stepmom and my dad, and everybody was feeling, because they, I just wasn't capable of that range of emotion at the time, or being able to understand the gravity of the situation.
Yeah, tears of gratitude.
They were just crying and hugging for a really long time. And I remember it was a very, like, emotionally loaded, charged moment.
So you came over, and how many siblings did you have? Your mom was on the plane as well? Who was on the plane?
Yeah, it was only me and my mom were on the plane. And it was the first time that either of us had ever been on the plane, because we don't travel. We wouldn't travel outside of Cuba. It's just not what you do. So we were the only ones, and I thought it was exciting. It was like a journey, and I was like, "Oh, a plane, I can see the city down there." And then for a while we only saw the ocean, and even for many years after that, it was the only time I had ever been on a plane, and it was the first time. And I remember they brought over some snacks and a blanket, and I was like, "This is fun." And my mom, she didn't have the same sort of feelings as I did, because it was a different story for her. It wasn't fun. It was just something she'd been waiting for years.
Yeah,
so
kind of relief. So this was this was more or less 20 years ago, because you're pretty close to mid-20s. You're 24, I believe.
Yeah, I was was actually probably 21 years ago. Yeah, 21 years ago.
So you came over with your mom. Now, did you visit and then go back to Cuba, or what happened with that stay once you left the airport?
That time that we came over, we never actually went back to stay in Cuba. That was our actually coming over here, and we stayed here and became U.S. citizens. But we did visit Cuba once after that, and it took a couple of years. I was 16 at the time we went back. It was about 10 years ago, and almost 10 years after I actually came from Cuba, we went back to visit our family. And it was just me and my mom and my little sister. Because for the longest time, my dad was actually afraid to go back since he left illegally. Like, Cuba didn't let him leave. He left on a raft against the government's wishes. So he was afraid that if we all went together, they might try to seek retribution of some sort. I don't know. I don't think they could have actually done that because he was already a U.S. citizen at that point, but he still had that fear. And that fear.
All right, listeners just joining, we are listening to Talia. She is my niece, and she came here. Her family came here from Cuba. And you're listening to 90.1 FM, Youth for Justice show here on People Powered Radio.
Well, had a hold of him. So he didn't go back for many, many more years after we even went to visit. Mm-hmm. But my mom and my sister and I did go, and we got to see all of our family. Because they're all there, and they're all still there. Except for me, my dad, my sister, and I had mentioned my mom's stepmom, so my step-grandma. Except for them, everybody is still there.
Sounds like from the timeline, it was a 2 or 3 year process from the time he was a refugee from Cuba, landing on a raft on the shores of Florida, to actually going through the whole process and getting citizenship?
Yep, it takes a while.
How did that work for you? So once you land in the United States, your dad's a citizen. Does that make you a citizen? Or what did your mom and dad have to go through once they landed to get their status?
So my mom actually is still not a citizen because she's able to be a permanent resident. Mm-hmm. But if she wants to become a citizen, she has to apply for the paperwork. And she actually tried to a couple of years ago. She practiced for the test, went to the immigration office. We all went with her to support her. But unfortunately, they said she didn't have enough command over the English language, so they denied it. And she hasn't gone back since because she was very discouraged. So she's waiting until she hits, I think, 55 years old. There's a certain age where if you hit it or if you've been here for that many years, you don't have to apply for it the same way anymore. You just kind of automatically get it. So she's waiting for that time to come up, but she's still just a permanent resident. As for me, because my dad was a citizen, I was able to just fill out some paperwork and become a citizen myself. But I my parents did most of that, so I don't know what it entails because I was a kid.
To me, that's just a little draconian. Your mom doesn't speak English well enough to be a citizen. Anyway,
she actually got all the questions right. Like, they have this test that I probably couldn't pass that has all, like, who was the U.S. president during this time and what are the words and, like, the anthem and things like that. She actually got all the questions because she had practiced it. But then they have an in-person interview where it's in English and they talk to you and ask you questions. And I guess speaking English is part of it. And it's kind of crazy. We were a little upset because depending on what area, there's no standard because it's an in-person interview and it's just the person who you're talking to is the judge of that, you know? So depending on where you go to get it, it feels like you might have a higher chance because we actually know a lot of people that don't speak English just like her that were able to get it, but they went to an immigration office in like the southern area of Florida where it is mostly Hispanics. My mom actually went to an immigration office in Tampa, which doesn't have as high demographic of Hispanics. So from our point of view, we think that definitely affected her chances. I think if we would have gone to one in Miami, she might have been better off.
So you're saying there's like I guess it would be a grandmother clause. So when she turns 55, she'll be like grandmothered in, so to speak.
Yeah.
Good for her. I'm rooting for her.
Yeah. She's only one year away, I think. So she's turned 54. So
for listeners just joining, you're talking to my niece-in-law, Talia Federico, dialing in from Florida. No, you're dialing in from Washington, D.C. area, correct?
Yep, Maryland.
And she's telling our listeners about her voyage to America from Cuba. So why don't we shift gears a little bit, Talia, and talk about growing up as a Cuban immigrant in the school systems of Florida.
It was only hard at first because I didn't speak any English when I came over, and they just put you straight into school. You have a couple classes, but they put you in ESOL classes, right, so that they can teach you English. And it's definitely easier to pick up as a kid. I picked it up. It was in a couple months or that first year, and I was good to go for the rest of my life. So thankfully, it was early enough in my life that my brain was still able to pick it up easily. But I remember the first couple of weeks to months, it was hard, and English sounded like gibberish to me. So I remember I would pretend like I could speak English by just gibberishing. So it was a little hard and a little frustrating, but eventually I just picked it up. I didn't even have to try because I was a kid, and I've been able to, you know, speak it ever since. It wasn't an issue. And as far as how difficult it was not, because we came into Hialeah, which is like, they call it Little Havana because it has such a high population of Cubans and Hispanics there. So it wasn't very hard. It was almost like being in Cuba because everywhere you go, they speak Spanish. They have Spanish food. They have people that are from Cuba. So it was definitely an easier transition to go there first. And then our family has since moved around and lived in other areas of Florida where that's not the case. But since we came right into Hialeah, I think it made the transition easier.
So it seems like the school that you were physically in had a large, quote-unquote, Spanish first language students that were going through the same process as you, learning the English language.
Oh, yeah. Like, my ESOL class was full. It wasn't just me and a couple other random kids. There's lots of kids that had English as a second language. So
when would you think that, you know, your quote-unquote language skills were at a point where you felt comfortable? You felt like you were talking and didn't feel awkward? Did it take a year or two? Or
it's hard to pinpoint that because it feels like it just happened. Like, it's not like being an adult and trying to study a language and learn it and then feel like you can actually hold a conversation. It really just happened, and it feels like it happened overnight, but it's definitely under a year of being here. After that, it was not an issue at all.
So in your home, you speak both languages, Cuban and...
I do, because since I learned how to speak English at a younger age, my dad always speaks English with me. Even though we can both speak Spanish, we always end up speaking in English. But my mom never learned English well enough, so we always speak Spanish. Sometimes I switch back and forth and speak Spanglish with my dad, but at home, definitely both. It's actually kind of a blessing for me, because if my mom had spoken just English, I'm not sure I would have been able to maintain the level of Spanish fluency that I was able to maintain, since I speak with her every day.
So people, and see, this is my level of knowledge, Talia, that's why I love doing radio. I learn as I go. But so the language that's spoken on the Cuban islands is Spanish? I was always considering they spoke Cuban.
No, they speak Spanish.
There you go, listeners. So I'm sure I'm not the only one that thought that folks in Cuba spoke Cuban.
I think I've heard somebody say that before, and it always sounds so funny to me. Well, it's like if people were to say, we speak American. We speak English. That's funny.
That's wonderful. So what was your dad's trade that he brought to the United States, the skill sets that have made him so successful and his family, you and your sister and your mom?
Well, I know in Cuba he was a civil engineer, but he can't actually, none of the degrees in Cuba actually count for anything here. And apparently it's like pulling teeth to try and get them to cross over, and it's a lot of money and a lot of work. So he was not able to practice civil engineering here. So he did all kinds of odd jobs when he first came over. He told me he was a janitor. He told me he was a delivery guy. And he worked at restaurants, like anything that he could get to try and save up money and make our lives better. That's what he would do. And I always looked up to him because he would tell me, especially like when I was younger in high school, and I had my first job at Dairy Queen, I always took something that he said with me. And he said, no matter what you do, even if you're cleaning toilets, you just do the best job you can. Nothing is beneath you, and you always do your best. And I always took that with me. And I feel like that helped me be successful no matter what I was doing. I worked at Dairy Queen, and I actually had that experience because you don't just sit there and serve people. We actually have to go to the back and clean everything. I had to take out the trash. I had to clean the bathrooms and the toilets and everything. And I never felt bad about it because I always remembered what he said to me. So I always tried to do the best possible job. I wasn't going to just sort of surfacely clean it. I was going to make that bathroom look the best it ever did. And I took that with me in every aspect of any job that I ever had. And I owe that to him. I always remember that he said that to me as a kid. So he had lots of different kinds of jobs. And eventually he was able to become a general contractor. And unfortunately, it was right before the real estate market crashed. But it's starting to pick up now, and he's trying to build a house for the first time or maybe the second time now. But he's always trying to come up with little odd jobs that maintain us throughout while he can, between one job and another. He's really creative. He came up with this one a couple years ago, snowbirds. I think he called it snowbird something. I don't remember. But basically, he was thinking a lot of people from up kind of where I live are flying down to Florida a lot, and they need somebody to watch their house or maintain their properties while they're away. I feel like the best thing about him is he's just really clever. So you can see what is needed, and he tries to take advantage of it and create opportunities for himself. But I always considered him very clever and very hardworking.
He'll be so beautiful. It'll be such a beautiful experience when he builds his first house using the skills that he had when he came here from Cuba so many years ago.
Yep.
You know, I've been blessed. I grew up in a town that's called the town of immigrants. So I grew up living with, you know, quote unquote mixed race. And, you know, we're so blessed, Talia, and I know you know this, the vast majority of people are just hardworking, good people. So what would you say to folks that, you know, all this horrible stigmatization and, you know, coming some of this national election, some of the crazy stuff has been said, you know, what would you tell our listeners as, you know, someone that's came to this country and the wonderful people that have done the same?
Well, I would just say, think about what my dad said to me. Always do your best no matter what your job is. Be the best at that job. And, you know, you will be able to persevere and move forward. And as far as the general election, I cannot even comment on that. Yeah. I have no idea where to even begin. I say at this point, there's nothing that we can do about what's going to happen right now. We can only sort of focus on ourselves. And I think we can better our country in our lives, one person at a time.
It's kind of like a continuation of what your dad said, but I like to vote and see the world through the eyes of, you know, it's a wonderful, beautiful place. Let's focus on that, and let's not focus on, you know, casting stones and stereotypes and all that kind of stuff. So thank you so much for calling in, Talia Federico, and sharing your story of coming to America from the wonderful island of Cuba.
Where they speak Spanish.
Where they speak Espanol. Youth for Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Uncle Dad's Art Collective. Symphony in collaboration with the North State Symphony presenting NSS Pops at Laxon Auditorium on Saturday, April 8th. The evening features a varied repertoire of arrangements from Duke Ellington to Daft Punk. The show will also be in Reading on Friday, April 7th. For tickets and more information, visit UncleDad.com. Also made possible by the Blue Oak School in Chico, developing public Waldorf education. Blue Oak Charter School provides rigorous academic standards and fully integrated music programs. Blue Oak is committed to nourishing and educating the whole child based on the natural developmental model. For more information or a school tour, call 530-879-7483 or visit blueoakcharterschool.org.
All right, back in the studio. Shout out to my family if they were dialing in, listening in from the East Coast. And we have Mark Alexander, man, our correspondent. What do you got, Mark? Give us some thoughts on what we just heard, man.
What I find interesting is that I feel like a lot of her experiences were so different, but I every time she kept talking about something, I felt like I had a similar experience, and it was reminding me of my life, even though it was so different. One in particular is she was talking about how her dad had left when she was really young to journey to America and try to bring his family over. And her for meeting him for the first time, not really having any memories of him because she was too young. I that really connected with me, being someone who had a dad who I knew existed, but I hadn't actually met face to face until I was a little bit older, and I was always kind of really excited to see him. But it was a very different situation. Her dad went off to make a better future for her family, while my dad basically just left my family. But I find family is very interesting, and it's very complicated, especially when you're a kid. Talking about immigration and refugees these days is a really heated topic, and I just every time I think about it, it's whenever I consider for a moment that you know, not when I think of them as people and not immigrants and refugees, as people looking for a future and working hard to get that future. No matter how much like cold, objective, thinking about whatever effects it may or may not have on the economy, I just can't bring myself to tell people that, you know, your family can't be here after they've spent so much time working so hard. And yeah, I just, it breaks my heart to see us, a lot of people these days, who don't think of, a lot of immigrants and refugees as, you know, people in that sense.
It breaks my heart, the whole thing, but you know, some of the other stories that you're seeing, and I interviewed someone that came from Syria that where they split the family. So, hey, we're taking you over the border. Hey, have a nice life.
I can't even imagine what that's like, being part of that family and having that happen to someone you love.
Well, thank you, Mark Alexander, for your in-studio comments. And we're going to transition to a neat little piece here. You know, Butte Environmental Council, we co-produced this show. And actually, I should say, you know, Alex Kokonakis and Josh Indar, I'm glad you guys have taken a month off, and you know, we filled the slots, but we always miss you guys, man. We're filling your sandals because we can't fill your shoes. But we did do the Butte Environmental Council segment this month, and it's all about endangered species fairs, endangered species fair, singular, and all the information around that, and making giant puppets here on People Powered Radio. All right, Gamma Mashia, man, it's my real pleasure. I have Natalie Carter, Executive Director of the Butte Environmental Council, lovingly referred to as Beck.
Feeling the love. Let's make some puppets.
We also have Kevin Killian, Beck Ooh, Board yay. Of Directors, and we're talking about all things giant puppets. Endangered Ooh. Species Fair and giant puppets. What's going on here, Natalie, and why are you so darn excited?
Well, coming up here this May, on May 6th, we have our 38th annual Endangered Species Fair. It's going to be at the 1 Mile Recreation Area. This is an event, like I said, we've been doing for decades, and is one that I have burned into my childhood memory, which was one of those things that made me so excited about getting involved with Beck when I did. This was one of the highlights, so I'm excited about that. And I always remember and have people remind me about the fabulous puppet parades that we do now and that we have been doing for years. And we are really looking to get some of the local art community excited and making some really big puppets that take 2, 3, 4 people to carry, so that we can add to this wonderful classroom parade and make it a full community event. And we're just hoping to make it fabulous.
Kev, got like a teaser for like a big party you're planning, right? I don't want to steal your thunder. What's going on, man?
Yeah. Hey, KZFR, what up? Looking good. All right, this is Kevin Killian. I'm wanting to invite y'all to a super fun puppet making party at my place. Coming up on Friday the 21st, we'll be hanging out from noon till 6. There'll be snacks, good times. We're going to make some giant puppets, lots of colors. And we'll be listening to KZFR. You can listen to The Dead, Peace and Social Justice Hour, and some Sanjay. So yeah, it'll be a good time. Come by my place at 1055 Spruce Avenue. That's near Mangrove. Again, 1055 Spruce Avenue. You can find information about this at the Youth for Justice Facebook page, as well as through Butte Environmental Council. And I'm looking forward to seeing y'all at the party.
Awesome. We're going to have Facebook pages to find all the information, too. They're going to be up soon. I know that.
Yeah.
It's my real pleasure to have Susan Trudy, one of the folks that host Ecotopia here on Tuesday evenings with her husband, Steven. And we're going to be here promoting puppets, giant puppets for the Endangered Species Fair Butte Environmental Council. Welcome to KZFR, Susan.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Puppets, what do we need to know about puppets? Because I know I was telling you how excited Natalie is to get more puppets. Yeah. Let's get everyone excited about puppets.
Well, it's a great fair. The Endangered Species Fair is a great fair. It takes place the first weekend in May. It's May 6th this year from 11 to 4. And a big part of that is the procession of the species. And we have about 300 kids, maybe more than that, making puppets for the Endangered Species Fair. And since they're little kids, they make puppets that are manageable for little kids, usually puppets on sticks, paper mache. We've had more ambitious kids make bigger puppets that they can carry on a platform, but I really want to have enormous puppets. I would like people in the community who are artistic, who are creative, who like to do fun team building projects, or, you know, just a group of friends making them, sororities, fraternities, clubs from the college, businesses and organizations. I'd like a solar company to make an enormous sun puppet. And my inspiration, I'll tell you my little backstory on this. My sons went to Evergreen State in Olympia, Washington, and Olympia has an enormous endangered species fair. And if anybody wants to be inspired by gorgeous puppets, you can go to the Endangered Species Fair in, I'm sorry, the Procession of the Species in Olympia, Washington. They're gorgeous puppets. Giant spiders that are operated by 9 people. But really, you can make a giant 2 or 3 person puppet that's manageable. Paper mache, recycled products, cardboard, fabric, lots of different ways of engineering a puppet. But we want endangered puppets the size of a Volkswagen.
That's a good visual. That's kind of like short and stubby, but I know there's one that my favorites is like 8 feet tall.
One of the ways of making a puppet is using PVC pipe, creating a puppet head that you then connect at the top of the PVC pipe, sorry, and either use a backpack or a waist band that you can put the bottom of the PVC pipe and carry it about 7 or 8 feet over your head. You can create wings with 2 more pipes. There are puppets that have people in the legs, and I think I might have some middle school kids who are going to create a cheetah in which 4 of the kids will be the 4 legs of the cheetah, and a 5th kid will do the head. I tell the kids that this is a project. It's an art project, a science project, and an engineering project, because you have to engineer the puppet so that it's manageable, so that you can carry it, so that all of its parts work, so that nothing falls off. And it's an artistic project because you're creating with recycled materials, with things that you can find at the ReStore, and you're creating an art piece from it. And it's a science project because what we're trying to do is, number one, call people's attention to endangered species, and number two, to create beautiful versions of endangered species, both to celebrate the species, but often also to recognize that they're in danger, they're at risk, and the closer we get to rising temperatures and the more population we have, the greater danger that many, many hundreds, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of animals, and we like big insects and big birds and big fish, so people can create any sort of a puppet that represents an endangered animal that they're really connected to.
Now, is this website you mentioned up in Olympia, the Processional of Endangered Species? Maybe
yeah.
That wasn't the term you used. Do they actually have some instructions on how to make the puppets and
they
stuff like that?
They don't have instructions so much as they have a beautiful whole gallery of mm-hmm. pictures that are inspiring. There are some websites that talk about how to make giant puppets, and so you can go there. I'm hoping to be working with some students at Chico State who will be making a giant elephant, and so I'm going to have them start out with engineering the puppet. You know, how can you create something that's light enough weight for you to carry, but that is substantial enough that it doesn't fly in the wind? Grub Education used to have a puppet that was a bird, and it's just a body on one stick and then the wings out on 2 more sticks, and it's a simple giant puppet. So you'll find descriptions for that on the website. You can also find on the Beck website, Butte Environmental Council, if you go to Endangered Species Fair and then the Procession of the Species, there's a puppet-making handbook. So anyone is invited to join this. There are no entry fees. The only thing we ask you to do is to register. If you're going to make a puppet, to register, there's a registration form online so that we can put you in the lineup. The parade has about 15 to 20 classrooms and then some other individuals that participate. So we just want to make sure everybody's in the lineup and we have everyone, we're accounting for everyone who's going to participate.
So when is the Endangered Species Fair? That's at 1 mile? What day?
1 mile. It's May 6th from 11 to 4. The procession of the species will be at 11:30. Sort of kicks off the festival, and we would like anyone who wants to join, and you have to start now, or you have to start within the next couple of weeks, because it takes, 10, 12 hours maybe to make a puppet, and I don't want to discourage anybody from starting, but you just want to make sure you have all the parts working and that you're able to paint it, that there are some parts that might be paper mache that you have to create and then wait to dry, so it involves a bit of time, but it's all really fun and all really creative. All really enjoyable.
So if you make the puppet, do you have to stage the puppet? So if you expect to make a puppet, you need to be at the fair with the puppet?
You don't have to come to the fair to make a puppet. I don't... Okay. Yeah, anybody can make puppets.
Boom. Anybody
can make puppets.
We should make a bumper sticker for that.
Yeah, season. Right.
Thanks a lot for being on.
Yeah, thank
Appreciate
you,
it.
Bill.
All
yeah.
Right. Shout out Susan Trudy. Had a wonderful time putting that together and a huge shout out for both her and Steve and her husband who do Ecotopia here on KZFR 90.1 FM. Going to take us back to this pre-record with Natalie Carter here on People Power Radio. What kind of puppets are we looking for, Natalie? You've got some ideas. Giant horns and stuff, right?
Yeah, well, so the idea is to raise awareness about endangered species. And so I was digging through the list of endangered species in California and got really excited when I saw the California bighorn sheep. Probably a little bit because of my Capricorn tendencies. My plot is to make myself some bighorns so I can represent the California bighorn sheep out there. And I'm looking forward to seeing the other animals that people connect with and decide to honor at this wonderful event.
What about you, Kev? You got any animals in mind, man?
My favorite endangered animal is the dinosaur. So we'll see what happens. I'm also like jellyfish. I don't know. Whatever it is, it's going to be big and beautiful, and we'll have it at the Endangered Species Fair, which is going to be awesome.
Make sure that you're there at the Endangered Species Fair. Maybe one more time on the particulars, Natalie Carter.
Absolutely. That'll be Saturday, May 6th from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. at the picnic area next to 1 mile in beautiful Bidwell Park.
Ooh, ooh.
Tune in next month, Youth for Justice, man. We're going to go through all of our fun times at the Puppet Make. I might even do some audio video work right there, huh?
We're going to have a good time.
Yeah, we'll have a good time. So thanks again, guys, for coming in. All right, I want to have a big round of applause. Big round of applause right now in the studio and beyond. Butte Environmental Council, man, give it up for them. Going to be doing right now a little bit of a PSA for them, something that's coming up this coming Saturday, April 8th. At the Arc Pavilion, 2040 Park Ave. It is called Sprout and Shout. Once again, Sprout and Shout, presented by Butte Environmental Council. It's a fundraiser to grow a new generation of environmental activists, which is like perfect for Youth for Justice. I'm going to be there. I'm being there. Saturday, April 8th, 5 to 8 p.m. Arc Pavilion, 2040 Park Avenue, Chico. Sprout and Shout this Saturday, 5 to 8 p.m., Arc Pavilion.
All right, back in the studio with Mark Alexander, our in-studio correspondent. Mark, what's your favorite endangered species that you might want to see as a puppet?
That's a tough decision. I would say, I'm not sure if they're endangered species anymore, but one of them would have to be wolves. The other one would have to be tigers. Tigers, probably just because they're such beautiful creatures, I mean, obviously, and it'd be just heartbreaking to hear, like, if we no longer had tigers in the world. Can you even imagine that? That'd be awful.
World without tigers would be like a world without Beatles music.
Right.
And they're coming up next, Beatle Nation, man. So what do you think about this gig? I got to give it another shout-out. Kev Killian, Friday 21st, noon to 6 p.m., 1055 Spruce Ave. What up, man? What are you thinking?
I immediately thought to myself when she mentioned Volkswagen-sized puppets, like, are those mobile? Like, do they operate them? Do they move around? Like, oh my gosh, I want to see this.
Yeah, I
want to see a giant spider puppet. That sounds awesome. That sounds like the best, Halloween toy you could possibly have. They should come around on Halloween. They should. Spiders.
You know what I'll do, Mark? Maybe I'll do it for everyone. I'll repost that actual interview with Susan was actually a video, a montage I put together. So it'll be out on Youth for Justice. So people, all the people that are going, I'd like to see what that looked like. We got it, man. We got it. What else you got, man? We got like another minute here. What else popped to your mind about Big Puppets and Endangered Species Fair, May 6th?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I find interesting is I sometimes I wonder to myself, like, how many endangered species do we actually lose a year? And I know it's actually a pretty startling number every time I hear about it. And it's, I find it scary that we don't actually, typically we don't hear about any species disappearing from our world, you know, from like news or anything, like news outlets like that. They don't talk about it. Mostly because I don't think people really obviously relate to really sad stories like that. I don't know if they want to hear about that, but I sure wish we could bring more awareness to it personally. I think it's a really important subject, and yeah.
Thanks a lot, Mark Alexander. It's always fun having you in the studio. You know, when we asked Mark to do this, he said, oh, I loved it to listen to things and comment on them, and, mm-hmm. and you do such a great job. It's fun having you here, man. And I get to see Mark Alexander at least once a month.
Yeah.
Which is always a pleasure. Shifting over to what's becoming a tradition, youth music here, ending the show. And we have, make sure I turn on your mic. Boom. So at least we'll be able to hear you, Jake. Jake Ketcher. He's going to lead us in to Beatle Nation with a song here. And what do we got, Jake? What do we got? What are we looking at, man?
Thank you very much. Actually, this is a song that I wrote a few years back. Most of my songs are homegrown, I guess you'd say. So I'm going to play a couple for you real quick,
all right,
and
Jake.
I hope you enjoy them.
All right. Jake Ketcher, KZFR, 90.1.
So prepare
Thank you.
Jake Ketcher, that was awesome, man. It's perfect timing. We got like 30 seconds. So why don't you swing around to the interview seat. We'll get a little information on, you know, how we can hear Jake Ketcher out and about Chico. And we're going to be bringing in the Beatle Nation crew, one of my favorite shows. And they really do such a fine job. But anyway, we got Jake on mic three, man. Give it up, Jake Ketcher. That was wonderful, man. You wrote all that? It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Closer. Beautiful, man. Tell us what we need to know about Jake Ketcher and how we can hear your bands, man.
The best way, I guess, is just through my personal Facebook under my name. It's Jake Ketcher, two words. Second name's a little hard. Last name's hard to spell. It's K-E-T-S-C-H-E.